Hello, everyone. Welcome once again to an exciting episode of Side Stories. As always, I am Aaron, and I'm joined by my special co-host today. Why don't you introduce yourself?
Hello. My name is Ryan Mooney. I am a special co-host, and I'm enjoying it.
He is wearing an I Am Knuff hoodie right now in his wonderful little tie-dye experience. He came prepared today, folks. So.
Because I am Knuff. Thank you.
This is some serious business today on Side Stories.
There is nothing more serious than being Knuff.
That's all you have to be in life, kids.
It's a lifestyle. It's a lifestyle. You got to commit.
So anyways, Ryan and I have done a few podcasts before this, but I don't think any of them are going to be in like the Side Stories like playlist. So because we've done a few episodes on music on like another kind of weird show we had that put out a few episodes of here and there. But maybe those will see the light of day sometime soon. But anyways, known Ryan for a while. He likes music. And Ryan, we're talking today about a very interesting subject, something that might be near and dear to the hearts of people who look like you.
Yes,
because you're kind of a hippie sort of person, would you say, right?
I try to avoid being accused as one, but I definitely kind of am one, considering who my parents are and whatnot.
Yeah, you're like half hippie.
Like half hippie, half metalhead. Like
part of a hippie legacy.
Yep, absolutely. I'm the new age hippie.
The new age retro hippie.
Absolutely. I'm more self-aware and modern.
That's the way of putting it, yes.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so real quick, tell me, what are your thoughts on Woodstock? What does that, like, evoke to you?
Well, Woodstock is, like, that, like, it's that, like, mecca for every hippie of, like, you know, if you could have been there at that one point in time, you could have seen a whole different world. You could have, you could have been there for that one moment in time where all the stars lined up, and for just a few days, everything was perfect. You know, the true hippie lifestyle was really a thing for a minute. You know what I mean?
It's, like, the defining moment of, like, the hippie movement sort of thing.
Absolutely. To quote Hunter S. Thompson, it's the high water mark where And nothing ever quite reached past that point after that.
It all just rolled back into the ocean, as you put it afterwards.
Yep, absolutely.
Yeah, and the reason I wanted to ask you that is because I was very curious about... I did a small little experiment here where I asked a few people I knew, like, I asked a few people I know what their thoughts on, like, Woodstock were, like, if they'd heard of it, that sort of thing. So, like, my mom, for example, I asked her, she was, I think, 7 when the original Woodstock went down, so obviously not there or anything, and was not raised by hippie parents by any sort of stretch of the imagination, but she had heard about it, and she kind of knew, like, oh, is this, like, hippie experience sort of thing? But what I was curious about is that Woodstock, which we're talking about today, obviously, is not just one event. It wasn't just one thing. It was actually ended up being a series of events and many, many more planned but failed events.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why I wanted to talk about that, because I think, at least especially if you're in an older generation, you probably know a lot of the basics of like that first Woodstock.
Oh, yeah. Everyone knows about the first one. You know, Jimi Hendrix, Alanis Morissette, Janis Joplin, the whole big zeitgeist shebang for it.
Yeah, it was, again, it was like that peak moment of that kind of counterculture hippie movement that had risen up at the time and then actually disappeared very quickly afterwards, which we're going to talk about today. So let's get into this, and as we go through this journey of the whole of Woodstock is the best way to think about this. We're not just focusing on the one you've heard of.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to talk about the ones that you have heard of, the ones you maybe heard of, the stuff you've never heard of, and the things that never happened.
Mm-hmm.
So it's going to be an all-encompassing sort of little series of episodes here. I'm not sure if it's going to be 2 or 3. We'll see what this ends up being, but that's what we're going for today. So jump right into it here. The original Woodstock was a 3-day festival, which became a 4-day festival because, as this will become a running theme, delays and overproduction and underproduction and scheduling concerns and all this will become very apparent very quickly.
I think it's at this point we should introduce our listeners to a game that we like to call, hey, look at that, there's 4 shadows over there. It's going to be a running theme throughout all of these episodes. There's a lot of foreshadowing and a lot of stuff that, like, you're going to notice it, and then it's going to keep popping back up to the point of where you're like, this feels like a fictional story. But it isn't.
Because history is more exciting than anything in fiction, is what I've learned through studying history. And that's, again, thank you for pointing that up, because there's a shocking amount of foreshadowing in history.
Mm-hmm.
It's very funny how people have this strange innate ability to, like, foreshadow things they have no way of knowing will happen in years or decades down the line, but somehow we have this strange ability to really tell where things are going, but only in retrospect. It's very strange. But anyway, so the original Woodstock, again, 3-day festival, became a 4-day festival. It was held on August 15th through the 18th, 1969, at a farm in Bethel, New York, located southwest of the town of Woodstock, New York. Became one of the iconic moments in the hippie countercultural movement. Many famous musicians played it. There was Jimi Hendrix, Santana, Janis Joplin, The Who, for some of the bigger names, but there also are a lot of like smaller and kind of mid-level names mixed in, people you've heard of, people you maybe haven't if you're in a younger generation.
I remember, like, John Fogerty, I'm pretty sure, was one of them at one point.
Yes, he was in there.
Cream was there, I think.
Cream, I don't think. Creed is Clearwater Revival was there.
That's
Cream wasn't. Canned Heat was there, too.
Yeah. I want to say like, Dr. Hook and his medicine show, maybe, too, but I could be crazy on that one.
Yeah, again, I don't have it all memorized in, like, the back of my head. The thing is, too, is there were also, like, smaller artists who I think, as people were kind of coming in and out, they weren't part of, like, the show, per se, but
right.
They were, you know, kind of there. And, in fact, actually, this reminds me, there was a professor I had at UND who taught rock and roll history.
Oh, God.
Which was
awesome.
A great, great class. I took it freshman year. But he talked about how he had met a woman who was actually at the original Woodstock Festival. And it's funny that the perspective, like, we talk about, like, the big bands and the event and that sort of thing. But the way she remembered it is like, oh, yeah, it was more of like one of those, like, kind of human be-in festivals. Like, we always kind of hung out and did stuff. And, oh, yeah, there was some music in the background sometimes. We didn't really care about that. Which is so funny that we talk about, like, the big acts that were there. But for other people who were there, it was more of just a big place to be at in some ways. So what started this whole Woodstock thing? Well, it comes down to four guys. They are, and remember these names. These will be on the test, Ryan, okay?
Absolutely. I'm writing them down right now. Okay. I got my pencil and my pen. We're ready to go.
Michael Lang, John Roberts, Joel Rosenman? I think it's Joel Rosenman.
That sounds right.
Yeah, Joel Rosenman and Artie Cornfield. Not Cornfield, given that many of these concerts are held
at
farms.
God, that would have been hilarious.
It would have been. But it's close enough. Artie Cornfield. All of whom were 27 or younger at the time when they put on the first Woodstock.
Yeah, so maybe you should get out of your mama's basement, listeners, and go on and do something with
your
life.
You should do something, by the way. Do it while listening to this podcast. But
yeah,
action is very important, and our generation sadly has a problem with lethargy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just saying.
I also have a problem with lethargy.
I mean, hey, I've had that problem too, but I'm also doing a podcast.
Have you or a loved one ever been impacted by lethargy? You could be entitled to financial compensation.
Mesothelioma too, but we can't help you with that one.
Not that one. We're not legally qualified on that one.
No, but that is important too, so get that checked out. But anyways, I'm going to go into details about these four guys quick here. So Artie Cornfield, he was a record producer, promoter, and composer. He became the youngest vice president of Capitol Records and the first director of rock music, I believe, at any major label that had, like, a director of rock. Or at least that's what he said.
That's really cool.
Again,
actually,
hard to confirm that, just because I did, you know, some of the records like Chess, I think, had come and gone,
mm-hmm.
or at least was about to drop out of the scene because Chess records didn't last that much longer past 1969. I think
Capitol Records is still around today.
Oh,
they?
Yeah, it is. Oh, yeah, Capitol's one of the bigger ones. Still.
I thought so.
Yeah, and there's all these other record companies, but according to him, he was the first director of rock music at any of the labels, and that was in 1967 when he got that position, where he would have been about 25.
Gotcha.
Depends on when his birthday was. I couldn't find exact dates of when they promoted him. I sadly don't have access to the Capitol Records filing cabinet that would tell me that, but I can do math, so roughly 25. And then prior to that, he had written and produced dozens of hit songs and had worked on over 100 records. He was kind of one of those people who, like, if you listen to someone who worked in the record industry for a long time, kind of like Rick Rubin or like Alice Cooper, like, they just knew literally everybody.
Right.
He
just
was
been
one
around, like,
yes.
Knows people who knows people who
he
knows
got in
people.
Young. He never left. Everyone knew him. Everyone talked about him in some way. He worked with everybody. Kind of like that. Like,
yep.
He was just one of those industry people.
Yep. One of those professionals that just, like, if you're going to be in the industry, you're going to have to know him at some point.
Yeah, and actually his background was part of the reason they were able to get some of these artists to show up, is that he kind of used his Capitol Records, like, connections or strings.
Really?
Even though I believe he actually retired out of Capitol Records before putting on the show, I think he kind of went full bore into Woodstock, but we'll get there. That's skipping ahead a little bit. Michael Lang, he's the most public face of Woodstock of all the four promoters. He's the one that, like, if you watch, like, the documentaries about Woodstock, usually he's the guy who's
there. Yep.
He's got the big frizzy hair. He looked like a stereotypical kind of hippie.
Very iconic looking guy.
Yeah.
Yeah. When you see photos of him from, like, any of the Woodstock concerts, he looks like the guy who would produce Woodstock.
You take one look and go, oh, that makes sense.
Yep. That to this. Yep. Got it.
Again, a very common theme in history. Like, oh, once I see it, oh, yep, no, I can just tell right away. So he had previously produced the Miami Pop Festival in 1969, which was another big show. He hadn't done, I think, too much else beyond that, but that was a big show. Like, Hendrix was there, Blue Cheer was there, a lot of the other kind of big name bands at the time were playing that show. Again, his connections kind of helped get people to the actual Woodstock as well. So he was the one that had any experience, but otherwise the other three guys really didn't have any experience with festivals or concerts at all. They all had, like, some sort of industry music experience, or at least played music themselves, but beyond, like, that kind of base level, they were not, like, actual, like, producers of concerts or venues or anything like that. So, again, keep that in mind. 75% of the people who produced this show did not have any experience producing shows.
Hey, look, I think I see a set of foreshadows over there.
More foreshadowing, yes. So, Cornfield and Lang grew up in the same record. Or, not in the same record. They grew up in the same neighborhood.
They grew up in a record? They were so thin!
They were on the record. They were very groovy. But anyways, the two of them grew up in the same neighborhood, and actually Lang had somehow heard about Kornfeld when he was working at Capitol Records. So he basically just popped into the office one day and said, "Hey, how's it going?" And they just kind of struck up a conversation and basically became fast friends after that. So they would hang out together. Lang would do his thing where they would just kind of hang out at Kornfeld's like apartment for a long time. And him and his girlfriend, who I think later became his wife, they were always kind of hanging out together. And, you know, he would miss the bus back home and he would just kind of sleep at Kornfeld's apartment. That sort of like 60s
very
hangout
groovy,
thing.
Yes. Very of the time.
Very much couch surfing kind of thing, but they didn't seem to mind. Like, they got along.
It was of the era. It was kind of... It seems like the thing to do at the time if you're going to be a hippie with a very wealthy businessman friend.
Yeah, exactly. And what happened then is that after a game of bumper pool, which apparently they play it all the time, at 2 a.m. on a fateful evening... Not sure if anyone seems to remember the exact date. Couldn't find it out there.
Probably
but...
a lot of drinking and drugs involved.
Yes.
So yeah, probably
sometime
not.
In 1969, they started talking about having a party where what if they rented a theater, got their friends together, and had their favorite artists perform for them? And like, oh, it'd be like such a great party, man. Like, that'd be fun. We've got everyone together. Like, what if we got like Bob Dylan and Hendrix and all these people? And like, we could maybe do that. And eventually that spiraled into starting a record production studio. So they had this original idea for like, wouldn't it be fun if we had a party, and that conversation morphed into, what if we went into business so we can kind of get all these artists together, right? Mm-hmm. And they thought about putting it in Woodstock, New York. And this is where the name Woodstock comes from. So Woodstock, New York is just a small town in upstate New York, but it had become a retreat for artists by the turn of the 20th century.
Interesting.
A lot of artsy types, you know, a lot of old school like artists.
Mm-hmm.
Whose names are kind of like gone to history.
I assume like painters and poets.
Yeah,
and
that
stuff
kind
like
of
that.
Thing. Musicians. They all kind of hung out in that area. It had that sort of vibe, for lack of a better term. I know vibe is like the most nondescript word in
but
the English language, but it works.
At the same time, I think it's very applicable.
But then there was like a new wave of popular artists who came into the area. Most famously, Bob Dylan lived in Woodstock for a time. A bunch of other artists came in through the area. And then Lang and Kornfeld's idea, again, morphed into, what if we just put a record studio there where the artists already are? So they met with two guys by the name of John Roberts and Joel Rosenman, who were new young New York businessmen. Let's talk about these two real quick here.
Please do.
They are also very interesting. So a few years before Woodstock, Roberts and Rosenman had put an ad in the New York Times, which read, quote, "Young men with unlimited capital looking for interesting, legitimate investment opportunities and business propositions," which was actually for a sitcom.
What?
Okay, so what they were doing here is they had a concept for a sitcom, right, which would feature... foreshadowing two young businessmen in way over their heads with tons of money.
Oh my god. Okay.
Yes.
Oh my god.
And they put out this ad to try and get people to contact them, and they would then use the ideas for episode the concepts.
Oh my god. What?
Yes, this is what they this is utterly genius. Right?
This is amazing.
And this was in 1967 is when they took out that ad. It was a few years before Woodstock. Mm-hmm. And funnily enough, Lang and Kornfeld never saw this ad.
Really?
This has nothing to do with the story. It's more of this is kind of what put these two guys kind of on the map.
Yep, got them on the path to Woodstock.
Yes. And they got hundreds to thousands of responses to this ad, by the way.
Really?
With tons of wacky ideas.
I did not think this would have actually worked. I thought this would have been like just like there's a weird ad in the paper. All right, flip to the next page.
No, tons of people called them and they had tons of like weird rambling conversations about just every strange concept under the sun.
Interesting.
And the sad thing is when I was trying to look up to see like what concepts people actually floated them, they've been kind of like tight-lipped about it, or they maybe haven't really mentioned it, or maybe they don't even remember.
Mm-hmm.
But they got a ton of response, but like what these things actually were, I couldn't really find. But if you do know, again, let me know. Or Rosenman is still alive. If you happen to hear this podcast, on the very off chance you do, please let me know, because I'd love to hear more of your story. This sitcom they were trying to produce, eventually, it basically just stalled out, and they put the idea on the shelf. And as far as I know, they never took it back off the shelf.
Aww.
There actually was going to be a movie based on the two guys, like Roberts and Rosenman's actual real lives.
Really?
In the 80s, Ralph Macchio was actually connected to it. And I forget who the other main actor was, but they tried to get off the ground. It, like, never happened.
Mm.
So, like, kind of telling this story has become, like, in a weird way, almost like Woodstock itself, where there's like a lot of attempts to get it back up and it doesn't usually work out. Anyways, they had this concept of, what if we did a sitcom? Put an ad in the paper. Eventually it didn't work. And then they're looking for more investment opportunities, right?
Right.
So also, for a little more background on them, Roberts was the heir to the Block drug fortune, which was a major producer of pharmaceuticals.
Huh.
Yes, that
answers so many questions.
Yes, also I found Block Drug was sold, I believe, in the early 2000s for, I think, like $1 billion.
Good God.
It also, like, it was a publicly traded company, but I believe they always ran it like a private business because the family that, again, Roberts was part of, they owned, like, however much of the stock and all.
Right.
So, yeah, a completely loaded, crazy family.
Mm-hmm.
And
that's
they sold,
insane.
Yeah, tons of, like, if you look up, like, old drugs,
mm-hmm.
a lot of the old drugs actually produced by this company, it
oh,
turns
good.
Out.
Cool, cool, cool.
So, but not, like, what the drugs that people
like
know
snake
about.
Not, like, snake oil stuff?
No, it would be, like, weird things like dental, like, gum cream and stuff.
Really?
Yeah, it was weird. It was, like, all, like, the weird drugs people don't remember, but were, like, sold everywhere at the time. But it wasn't, like, they didn't sell, like, cocaine. It wasn't, like, that kind of old drug. No, it was just more, like, weird, like, ailment, you know, reducing sort of over-the-counter stuff.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah. Anyways, that's its own tangent for maybe another episode. And then Rosenman was his best friend. They had opened a recording studio together. So it's funny that these guys actually had the recording studio, which is what caught the attention of Lang and Kornfeld, not the sitcom ad, shockingly. So Lang and Kornfeld, having found that these two rich guys looking for investment opportunities
right.
who were in the same age range, had kind of the same ideas. Both of them had done some work of music beforehand too,
mm-hmm.
little things here and there. They pitched the idea of opening another recording studio in Woodstock, right?
Right.
And eventually this idea is what morphed into, what if we put on a big concert instead? Kind of getting back to that original
That's wild that it went
idea.
Concert to recording studio,
back to concert. Yes. And so the idea was, like, what if we get a group of people together and, like, we have this big show and it'll be fun. And, you know, Lang had done the pop festival down in Miami. And it's like, oh, let's do this. It'll be fun. It'll be groovy. Whoa,
it'll be
out,
romantic,
man.
And it'll be everything we ever wanted.
Yeah, it'll be great. Also, the way I believe Kornfeld tells this is that they had, like, kind of concepts for, like, Lang and Kornfeld were already in business and they had started.
Mm.
I can't remember the exact name of the company, but they had started their own little company and they even had, like, little doves on it. It was like an American, like, kind of typeface and all that. And the stuff that became, like, iconic and involved with Woodstock was starting to form, but they basically had, like, a not company, he called it, just looking for any opportunity.
That's interesting that, like, the iconography, like, predates the actual event
yeah.
itself. You would never guess
and
that.
Actually, the guy who drew the original logo is the same guy who did artwork for the Rolling Stones' Let It Bleed album, which came out in 1969, one of the most iconic images and albums of that time.
Mm-hmm.
And he did a bunch of other art, too. So,
God,
yeah,
that's cool.
Yeah, it's kind of like a who's who of, like, people that just kind of came together and became big names. Using their connections, they signed on Sly and the Family Stone, who was a friend of the producers that everyone kind of knew.
Mm-hmm.
Another one of the big acts that was signed on early was Creedence Clearwater Revival. And if those names, eventually they were to kind of convince other people, like, hey, it'll be this far out concert, sign on. So eventually they got Hendrix.
You know, we've got,
hey,
we've already got these people signed up. You should sign up too, man.
Mm-hmm. Which is funny because actually the original person that Lang and Kornfeld had claimed they could get was Bob Dylan, who they actually couldn't get. And then Roberts and Rosenman found out they couldn't get Bob Dylan and it became a little contentious.
That's hilarious.
Yeah, a little bit of tension rose between them. So yeah, they didn't actually ever get Bob Dylan, who was supposed to be their really big get. But oh well. Roberts and Rosenman, despite the not having Bob Dylan, they still had a big event planned and all this sort of thing. And actually, the event was not planned to be in Woodstock, New York itself. From the sound, I've read in some places that Woodstock, well, the towns, there's a lot of towns they tried to shop this with, but I've read somewhere that Woodstock, the town, eventually turned them down.
Interesting.
But everyone who was kind of more involved said they never actually tried to get into Woodstock, so it kind of becomes like a he said, she said kind of thing. But anyways, we'll get into the town thing in a second here. But despite all this, you know, kind of, okay, we don't have a place exactly, but we, you know, we have an idea, we have a concept, we have some bands we're starting to get that we could talk to.
Mm.
They put up $250,000 to fund the festival.
Good. Then,
which would,
is that like in 1960s money?
1960s money.
Oh boy.
Which would be over $2 million in today's money.
Oh boy.
Yes. I actually ran the numbers through calculations. So the festival suffered issues regarding location, scheduling, setup, weather, and overattendance. Almost immediately things went wrong. In fact, the town of Wallachill was the first place they had tried, and actually they had things mostly set up there and actually built, and then that got shot down.
So they were building it before they shot it down.
Yes, so they're trying to get the festival off the ground, right?
Mm-hmm.
And they have a bunch of different locations. Wallachill shoots it down. They may or may not have tried Woodstock. They try a bunch of different places. Eventually they find one spot where they're able to actually get permission and go through like the county like councils and all that sort of thing and start building, and they have most of it set and built, right? 5 weeks before it's supposed to go on, they shoot down the whole festival.
Oh my god, that is
5 weeks.
That is hilarious.
Yes. So now they are a concert that's mostly set up in a place they can't produce the concert with bands who are eating their lunch, because many of these bands start to realize that they are first timers, and so some people are like double charging them, like twice the going rate, like pay us double what we normally go.
Oh my.
Yeah, so they're just getting gouged for money. They don't have a location. They're scrambling 5 weeks to go, right?
Oh man.
And towns are shooting them down everywhere. Again, Wallachia was the original place. May tried Woodstock. They tried a bunch of different places. They're all kind of in like roughly like an hour to 2 hour like mm-hmm. drive radius in this part of upstate New York, if you look at a map.
Right.
Eventually, a guy who is a dairy farmer is who saves them.
That's so funny.
And it's Max Yosker, I believe is how you pronounce his name. He is a 40-something-year-old dairy farmer, and I think he hears about them looking for the festival location. I think it's his nephew who tells him that, like, hey, there's these promoters looking for a spot. Why don't you go and talk to them? Because I know the dairy farm isn't doing so hot, and you don't want to sell it off, so why don't you
try
that?
Make some quick and easy cash.
Yep. So
that's hilarious.
He comes in and basically saves the festival. So now 5 weeks to go. They have to go scramble to a random dairy farm. Mm-hmm. They have to pay the guy who's hosting the dairy farm, and they have to build everything right away.
That's so amazing. It's
great, but it just does not go very well.
No.
Originally, they expected about 40,000 attendees, and then they had to start upping the amount of people who showed up, right? Because they tried to advertise this a lot.
Right.
I'm sure almost everyone has seen like the famous Woodstock, like it's Guitar of the Dove sitting on it. That poster gets thrown around everywhere.
There's like the one that had like the 3 days broken up in like the middle of the poster, and it's like red, yellow, and blue.
Yeah.
Like a bunch
of advertising goes out. And they also, the funny thing is, the original advertising had the original location on it too. So then they have to redo all the posters.
Oh my God.
And then tell everyone it's not canceled, it's in a different location. Upstate New York.
Oh, in the 1960s.
Yes.
So you're not like doing it through text and stuff.
This is before there's no internet. There's nothing digital. All this is done basically like either in person or by phone or maybe a letter.
Yep.
Like that's about all you can do.
Maybe like in the newspaper if you're
real
lucky.
Yes, if you're
something.
Lucky. Yeah, if you can get someone to do that. And so they are scrambling. They're already massively in the hole because a lot of bands are not only demanding double their rate, they're demanding upfront payment.
Oh, yeah.
So they are already like losing insane amounts of money. Just crazy. It's flying everywhere. And if they don't get this show off the ground, what the heck are they going to do, right? They're just going to be like in the hole forever.
Game over.
Yeah. And you know what the worst thing is that happens next is that they realize people are starting to show up. Like a lot of people. Before the show was ready.
Like a lot of people.
Like a lot of people. Like tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands of people start showing up.
Oh, it's like a mecca.
Yes, it's becoming a mecca very quickly on a random dairy farm with very few facilities.
In the middle of nowhere.
In the middle of nowhere.
In upstate New York.
Yes, there are traffic jams that extend for miles throughout this entire event.
I'm sure it's probably like a one-lane dirt road too or something like I used to grow up on.
It's possible. Like to actually get to the farm, I can't imagine it was too... set up. Like, there's highways nearby that get blocked, too, so I can't imagine the rural roads must have just been terrible.
Awful.
And people start showing up before they get the ticket office and the gate up. They actually are in the middle of, because again, they have to reconstruct this whole thing, right? They got, I don't even know, like, how much of that original set they had built in wherever it was. I don't know how much they can take or down and bring over there. Like, I don't know what materials they even have, or if they have to just start from scratch. It'd be very interesting to find out, like, how much of it is actually the original Woodstock stage and never got used. I'm sure that's just lost to history.
Instead of Theseus' ship, it's Woodstock stage.
It really is what it should be. I think people might get that reference
nowadays.
Though Theseus is a little bit of a smarter reference, but whatever. Anyways.
More academic.
A little more academic, which it probably should be given it's a philosophical question. So they don't have the ticket office up. They don't have fences. People are just streaming into this field and hanging out and setting up tents, and they have no way of getting rid of them, by the way. And there's probably, it's numbering in the thousands. It could be tens of thousands before the show starts, right?
Right.
Estimates vary. It's a lot of people.
Yeah.
So Michael Lang eventually makes the call of he starts to set up the stage rather than anything else, right? Mm-hmm. Some people have prepaid tickets. It was supposed to be if you prepaid tickets, it got them a little bit cheaper. If you paid for them at the gate, they're going to be a little bit more expensive, right? To entice people to come
Usual way, as you do,
right? So... with very limited facilities and knowing that people were streaming in, Michael Lang said, quote, "You do everything you can to get the gates and the fences finished, but you have your priorities. People are coming and you need to be able to feed them and take care of them and give them a show. So you have to prioritize. So they focus on whatever bathrooms they can, the stage,
mm-hmm.
basically whatever they can do to at least get people settled and have some sort of facility so they're not
right.
just crowding everywhere. And they say, it's a free concert now because there's no way to charge anybody. So now you can't even charge at the gate for this giant in the hole concert.
Oh, no. Oh, this is going great, guys.
Yep. And you have traffic jams for miles
mm-hmm.
to reach the festival. So more people are trying to come and they are just abandoning cars on the interstate. People are breaking down and needing help on the side of the road. People are walking through this. People are driving motorcycles through this.
Mm-hmm.
The people, like, this actually got declared a state of emergency.
You're kidding.
No, that's the state of New York declares an emergency so, like, the National Guard could fly in more supplies to just keep people from rioting.
What?
Yes, like, you
no
like,
one ever talks about what?
Yes, the governor declares a state of emergency.
Oh my god, that's so funny.
Yes, no. you can find footage of, like, helicopters unloading, like, supplies to Woodstock to keep people fed.
Oh my god.
Yes.
Hey, kids, what's that over there? I think that's more shadows.
Yes, it's
oh my god.
Nuts.
I didn't know that. That's incredible.
Yeah, there are, again, and there's more, like, wacky stories going on, which I'll get into. I didn't want to just repeat, like, the classic, like,
yeah,
everyone's
yeah.
kind of heard the Woodstock stories, like, oh, it was this free love fest,
No, no,
man.
No, this is amazing.
Yes, and I didn't just want to repeat all of that and be like, oh, then Hendrix played the national anthem. Like, that's great. The thing about Woodstocks, typically speaking, is that most of them kind of speak for themselves. Like, if you could find the footage,
yep.
if you want to watch what happened there, you could just watch it. But I want to talk about, like, the stuff that you can't see on camera.
Right.
I want to get more into, like, the background details. We'll talk about the events and, like, the shows a little bit here, because that's coming up. But
yep.
I didn't want this just to be, like, the your average, like, on TV, like, documentary, like, that just covers the artists, which is great.
Right.
And all, and it's important, but you can find that anywhere.
Yep. We want to be different and
yeah.
unique.
If you want to see that, again, I highly encourage you to watch these shows. They speak for themselves. A lot of them are great. I'm going to talk a little about them here and there.
Yep.
Let's talk more about the actual production of the show, which
yeah.
people don't talk about. So once the show finally started, things were going all right, though there were frequent delays between performances due to, again, technical issues, weather, and artists not being there. In fact, the original planned show opener was a band called Sweetwater. They were delayed by the traffic jams. Even the artists couldn't get there. They actually had to take a helicopter to get there.
Oh my god.
And that's why Richie Havens, who is the famous opener of the show, I believe he started at 5:07 p.m. exactly, which I think is delayed from the show's start.
Right.
That's why he opened.
Really?
He was not the original show opener. And he actually had to stall for time. He started playing Beatles covers, like, once his set was done, because he was still waiting for Sweetwater to get there.
Oh, that's great.
And if you've ever heard, one of his famous songs is called Freedom. He ad-libbed that whole song at the show.
Really?
That's him filling time.
Really?
Yes. A lot of this stuff that became really famous about Richie Havens is things he just had to fill time at for Woodstock.
That's amazing.
It kind of
him.
Made part
That's
of his
so
career.
Cool.
Yeah. He again, it's really interesting if you watch his performance.
That's
like,
legendary.
It is. Like, and a lot of this stuff, this is kind of a common theme. Again, foreshadowing. The frequent delays are also why, like, for example, Hendrix played Monday morning, right? Because it's supposed to go Friday to Sunday, right?
Yep.
Hendrix was supposed to close Sunday evening.
Mm-hmm.
He closed Monday morning.
Mm-hmm.
At, like, gosh, I don't remember what time exactly, but the crowds that had come and gone, estimates range for the total number of people who were in attendance to Woodstock to be anywhere from, like, 300,000 people to, like, up to 1 million.
Jesus.
Which, I feel like the million's kind of pushing it. The
yeah.
most quoted I see is right around 400,000 to 500,000, which is still a lot.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I remember the one of the oft-quoted, like, little fun facts is that if this area had been its own city in New York, it would have been the third biggest city in all of New York State.
That's hilarious.
So for, like, 3 days, yeah, see, again, just descending on this small, like, area near Bethel, New York.
Yep, the small little dairy farm in the
yes.
middle of nowhere.
With all these people who you did not plan to be there.
Nope.
With limited facilities. And again, remember, the Woodstock experience is you're rolling around in the mud.
Yep.
People are off making free love. People are off
doing
a lot of drugs.
Yep.
People are off drinking. People are off kind of listening to music sometimes. Sometimes they're not. A lot of this is just people, like, a lot of the photos, it's funny, if you look at the photos of crowds from Woodstock, there's no stage anywhere near them.
Nope.
They're hanging on some hill somewhere with tents.
Having a great time.
Yeah, they're just, yeah, sometimes there was music. That's
yep.
kind of the Woodstock experience, is you just hung out and it was a party.
Yep.
Right? And just to give you a little bit more of an idea of how, like, overblown the show was, Hendrix performed to a crowd of about 25,000 people. Sizable, but only a fraction of the hundreds of thousands of people who had been there in the days
yep.
prior.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, oh my god.
And he was one of the main headliners. He was the draw.
That's...
And he performed to, like, a sizable stadium.
Mm-hmm.
Not, like,
nothing Mac, like...
Not a city.
Yeah.
Yes. Like, it's nuts that people showed up for all that. Also, there was almost a near total disaster in the middle of the show that, again, people don't really talk about. Those only averted by Joel Rosenman. The Who and the Grateful Dead, two other of the big bands who played there, refused to go on without being paid up front.
Right.
Right? But it's a little bit hard to get the timeline on this event, but I believe they're basically at the show.
Okay.
Right? But they're not going to go on until they get paid.
Of course.
Right? Of course. Because I mean, why not? I mean, they're seeing what's around them.
Yeah, they're seeing how great this is going.
Yeah. And kind of fair.
Yeah,
right?
Absolutely. I wouldn't blame them.
Maybe a little bit poorly timed, but
yeah.
Fair. So Joel Rosenman is like, oh crap, if we don't have the Who and the Grateful Dead play, like, we're going to have a huge gap in the show. The kids are going to, like, riot, right?
Yep.
So wanting to avert anyone getting hurt, he then makes a call to his banker in the middle of the night when this is happening, and then he flies a helicopter out to land on his banker's backyard to then pick him up so that he can go to the bank and write a cashier's check for the Who and the Grateful Dead to play.
Oh.
Because this is the 60s and there's no digital currency. You can't wire this. It's got to be a cashier's check. And you got to be in the bank in person getting that. I'm not sure if Joel Rosenman goes to the bank himself because somehow it sounds like how this is being retold again by him. It sounds like Joel Rosenman gets the check either at the bank or there might be a relay or something. I'm not quite sure, but it sounds like he then has to drive his motorcycle basically through the crowd of people to get to the stage.
This sounds like the funniest and worst Mission Impossible movie I've ever heard, and I love it so much.
Yes, he even said for a little while he felt like a hero. When he got to, like, the edge with the cashier's check in his backpack,
yeah,
Janis Joplin was playing.
Oh, my.
And he stopped for a second and went, wow, I feel like a hero. This is kind of like a beautiful one. He's on the edge of seeing this sea of people that he's helped, you know, he's been a big part of getting together, and they're having this huge moment. And he's like, wow, this is incredible. Oh, yeah, I better get to the stage real fast.
Oh, yeah, I got to do this really quick. Go, 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 go.
Run through the crowd to get them this check, and they both go on. Apparently, both put on really good sets.
Oh, hell yeah.
So it worked out, but, like, I mean, what a
mess. By the
skin
of your teeth.
Yeah, they are literally still paying people backstage at this show. Like, it is that much of a mess.
Oh, man.
Like, basically, nothing goes right. But the thing is, there were problems that happened at Woodstock with, like, the crowd. Like, actually, two people died, one of an that we know of.
Mm-hmm.
One of an overdose, but apparently that was also caused by, like, the pre-existing conditions.
Mm-hmm.
One kid was also run over by a tractor.
Oh my.
And apparently this was in some field. I don't know how much on the concert grounds this was. Like, this must have been somewhere nearby.
I'm sure, like, there wasn't really a fence or anything.
No, there was no fence.
The difference between, like, where the farm is
and where someone else's farm is.
Yeah, yeah, I'm sure it's probably just people strewn out in a general area.
Yes, because the way I'm hearing this, he was either covered by a blanket or a sleeping bag, and the farmer didn't know, and it was, like, either early morning or at night, and the tractors ran him over.
Oh, God.
Yeah, and so, like, that was one of the fatalities. It's also a myth that babies were born there.
Really?
That's a myth. There were probably a lot of Woodstock babies 9 months later.
Oh, yeah, almost certainly.
But not at the concert. There were no confirmed births. Though I can't remember which artist it was. One of them got on stage and said that he had heard that. That was apparently a rumor spreading through the
interesting.
Crowd.
Interesting.
That's been deconfirmed as far as there's no evidence that anyone, that this happened.
Honestly, so, interesting.
Fun fact, but there were a few just accidental, kind of like uncontrollable deaths.
Yep.
There was also a stunning lack of security. In fact,
oh,
do you know the story about the security at Woodstock?
I know this. I don't know the full story, so please illuminate.
Okay,
me.
Well, did you know Wavy Gravy?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
The guy who literally was a professional clown that they hired to basically take care of the freakout tents, they called it, and then basically tell people to stop being mean if they were being mean, and he threatened to cream pie people in the face with a literal pie, like if they misbehaved. This somehow worked, by the way.
You're kidding.
Basically, as far as I know, like, I'm sure there were disturbances, but, like, if they were, they seem to be pretty much lost to history, or at least very rarely talked about.
Interesting.
Like, I'm sure some people got into some fights, I'm sure people fell and got hurt. Like, there were injuries.
When you have that many people in that small area, it's gonna happen.
Like, what you expect, but as far as I know, there were no major disturbances or riots or anything. People kept mostly, probably because the show kept going on, and there was also that kind of peace and love kind of thing going through the air, and also everyone was so high they couldn't
and
move.
I was gonna say, it's 1969, so it's like, you know, peace and love and free will,
like,
man.
That still kind of was going through
still
the air.
Still the hippie revolution, you know?
Yeah, man, don't be mean. Don't have a cow, man. And yeah, that kind of thing.
Yep.
Yeah, so how true that is, a little hard to tell, because, again, not necessarily footage of the entire crowd out there. It's 1969, but according to the stories and what people tell you and the sources I found, generally was not a disaster, generally speaking. Muddy, but not a disaster.
Oh, yeah.
Eventually, by the end of this whole thing, people go home. Hendrix finishes. He plays the Star Spangled Banner. Everyone's happy. Yay, right? You had an iconic show. And the media is eating this up, right? Because people knew that there would be media footage and, like, things would be recorded at Woodstock.
Right.
But I don't think anyone quite expected to become kind of the circus it was with so many people being there. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, you got to cover the story. So press is coming out. People are getting interviewed. They also filmed the whole concert. You can find all the footage online if you want. There was an album put out. There's also bootlegs out the wazoo everywhere. Oh, yeah. It's all out there. If you want to see any of this, you can look it up. It's all very, very documented. The crowd stuff, a little bit harder. So by the end of this, right, once this whole thing has gone down, it left the promoters nearly bankrupt.
Yep. Sounds about right. Given how all the finances were handled, I'm amazed they had any money left over whatsoever.
Yes. And actually, the interesting thing is that thanks to the film and soundtrack rights, that's how the festival became profitable.
You're kidding me.
Yes.
George Lucas'd it?
Yes, they did. And funny story about that. It was a month after the events that Roberts and Rosamond sold 85% of the rights to the Woodstock film and the records to Warner Brothers.
Really?
With Roberts and Rosamond holding the trademarks to the logo through Woodstock Ventures. By the way, Woodstock Ventures is the company that they formed to host this whole event.
Gotcha.
It's actually still around. I have things to talk about that later.
Cool.
But yes, Woodstock Ventures is the basically Woodstock.
Yep.
In the best way of putting it.
Right, right.
The company, again, it was formed in 1969, produced the festival. It still owns, again, all the trademarks and IP and everything. And they are, of course, to this day, still selling Woodstock merchandise.
Of course.
Because of course not. I'm sure they are no doubt getting lucrative royalties from all this.
Gotta do that. Gotta absolutely make the money while you can.
Now, however, Roberts and Rosenman, despite making so much money off royalties, they only broke even by 1981.
Really?
Yeah. Crazy.
Really?
Over a decade later. In fact, actually, that didn't last. Legal disputes over the IP put them back in the red.
That's hilarious.
If you read any interviews with them, they are constantly talking about how they never made any money off Woodstock. Though they don't seem bitter about it, actually. They took great pride in their accomplishments. They just like to point out, I didn't make any money off of that. Just to let people
know. Just a fun little side adventure.
I think one of the numbers that's been quoted, it was either after all the legal fees and stuff came in or right after the concert. But at one point, they were $100,000 in the hole.
Oh, my.
Yeah. And again, that fluctuated throughout the years, like up, down, up, down, up, down. In fact, Kornfeld and Lang later sued Roberts and Rosenman in 1970, claiming they had been, as they put it, tricked into selling their shares of the proceeds. But this was later dropped. Kornfeld claimed it was because they didn't have the money to fight it in court.
That's funny. Damn. So, ironic.
Yeah. So it became this big mess. And again, my main takeaway from Woodstock, which, again, you can agree or disagree however you want, but again, as someone who wasn't there and was not even born for a long time afterwards, my takeaway from it is, after reading about it, it's a rushed, poorly planned, star-studded mess of a festival that took place at the right cultural moment for it to become an iconic event. Generally speaking, and actually according to the promoters themselves, they just got really lucky that nothing went horrendously wrong because they were just begging and pleading and praying this whole show that nothing would go wrong, that people wouldn't riot, that no one would get hurt. Like, they just kept trying to put on a good show, give people the facilities, keep getting that state of emergency food and supplies and stuff out there.
Hope FEMA level stuff.
Basically. That was the whole show. The whole 3 days. Whole 4 days.
It's one of those things where it's just, how do you even get that lucky? Like, what are you born with, like, to have that amount of luck to where this kind of disaster, because this, I think from an outside perspective, just objectively speaking, this festival should have burned to the ground.
It never should have happened.
Exactly. It should have been a disaster from day one. And it was. But it could have been so much worse.
Yes. And again, people who were at Woodstock tend to remember it very fondly.
Yeah, which
generally
is
speaking.
Wild.
Yes. Like, again, there's a reason we're talking about Woodstock to this day. And it wasn't the first big festival, but it was one of the biggest.
And it's the one that, like, really entered the zeitgeist, I feel.
Yes.
Like, you can say the name Woodstock and anybody will know what you're talking
about.
Yes.
They have the image of tie-dye and hippies and mud and bands and, you know, being like pro, you know, freedom or something.
Free love and free spirit.
And like anti-war, like make love, not war, that all kind of hippie.
The revolution, man.
Yeah, whoa, man. Like, oh, man, you had to be there. Like that kind of thing. And it's interesting to see how it's kind of fallen like into the zeitgeist. It's tightly packed in there, right? It'll never really go away, but it's also something that I think a lot of people have like a lot of misconceptions over. Like, they think, like,
well, there's a lot of it, I feel, has been so fictionalized
and
so mythologized at this
point.
And
that's also something that a lot of people who were there will say. Like, it wasn't, like, the stars didn't literally align and, like, we all floated in the air kind of thing, you know?
Right.
But it was still, people knew even at the time, like, this is pretty big deal. You can't get 500,000 people somewhere and not have it be kind of important,
kind
at least.
Kind of fun, yeah.
Yeah.
Kind of a thing.
Yeah, a little thing.
Yeah.
After hearing all that, what are your thoughts on, like, Woodstock now? How have they changed, if at all?
But to be honest with you, I would say that my thoughts on Woodstock have largely very much remained the same, at least for the first Woodstock. Because it's still the Mecca. It's still that, like, that the house on the hill, you know, that you can look at and go, man, that one time. Yes, obviously all the facts there that it was should have been a disaster, but it wasn't, and it was, people enjoyed it, and it was entertaining. It was fun. People had a good time, and at the end of the day, that's the most important part of a concert, I think. So
it worked.
I don't want to call it a success, but it somehow was.
And not so much, like, they did kind of get, like, they were really under the gun once, like, the first location pulled out. Because then, like,
yep.
What the heck are you going to do?
Yeah, at that point, that's when it's like, well, it's either do or die at this point.
Yeah, and they were just so invested. Like, you got to try to get something. And
yep.
Also, Michael Lang's, like, personality was a big thing that brought them through. Because he was the, like, we can do it. The show's got to go on kind of guy.
Yep.
Foreshadowing.
Someone's got to be the
one. Lots of foreshadowing there.
Go ahead and write that one down,
viewers.
It's going to be on the quiz later.
Because Michael Lang, he'll keep popping up.
Oh, he never stops popping up.
We'll also talk about, like, the lasting legacy of Woodstock, but just for the record, because we're talking about, you know, the four main guys who helped put on Woodstock, I just wanted to mention that Roberts himself passed away in 2001 of cancer. Lang just passed away in 2022. Rosenmond and Kornfeld are still alive to this day, and they still talk about Woodstock and do all this sort of thing. But Lang was usually the one, like, all of them were kind of involved in later Woodstocks, but Lang was the guy who hung around the most. But let's talk about those other Woodstocks we got. Now, I'm not going to talk about the ones you've probably heard of.
No.
I'm going
to
try and quickly go over the ones you've definitely not heard of, because Woodstock left quite an impression, right?
Yeah, a lot of lasting memories.
So, yes, after the hippie wave faded, which I should mention real quick, the Woodstock, like, high only lasted until about the end of 1969.
Yep, literally it was the summer of 69. Yep.
There was a little thing called the Altamont Free Concert I wanted to briefly talk about.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yes, and I'm not going to go into a ton of details about the whole show, just because I think we're probably going to talk about that at some later date, because that's a wacky, wacky story. But basically what happened is that Altamont was supposed to be, and it was advertised as, the Woodstock of the West. It was supposed to be a free concert. The Rolling Stones were going to headline. Tina Turner was there. There was supposed to be, like, a bunch of other people. And, like, it was supposed to be, like, people talk about, like, a Rolling Stone show because they were the main headliners. But
yeah.
It was supposed to be a festival.
It was supposed to be a big thing.
Yes. And then it became a complete disaster, held on a racetrack. The Hells Angels killed the guy.
Yep.
And
they were also hired as security.
Yes.
Really worth mentioning. They
yeah.
They were the security for the Peace and Love concert.
Yeah.
Headed by the Rolling Stones.
Yes. Which
sounds
not
weird to say it out loud, right?
Yeah, and the Rolling Stones were funnily not really a peace and love band even at the time.
No!
But, yeah, this became a giant mess, and let's just keep this focus on Woodstock and not get down that rabbit hole right
yep,
now.
Yep.
We'll talk about it later, don't worry. One day, but that killed hippie the movement. Like, it was already
yeah,
starting to kind of fade,
that
actually.
That was the pull it behind the barnyard. Yeah.
Yeah, and that happened in December 1969, by the way.
Yep, so literally right at the end.
And
that's,
fittingly,
that's so poetic.
The album that basically bookended 1969 was the Rolling Stones' Let It Bleed,
mm-hmm.
which closes with You Can't Always Get What You Want and opens with Gimme Shelter. Pretty much the entire zeitgeist of that whole year.
Yep.
Like, yeah, the flower power thing really died post-Altamont. It's one of the most infamous things that ever happened in rock and roll. Hippieism began to fade. The degeneracy and debauchery and the decadence of the 70s sit in.
Very much was around to stay.
But at least the music got better, because I will say I prefer 70s music to 60s
oh,
music.
Oh, God, yeah.
Yeah.
It's Led Zeppelin versus the Beatles. I mean,
yeah,
don't get me wrong. The Beatles
on.
Are nice, but it's Zeppelin.
The Rolling Stones hit their heyday.
You see bands like Ozzy Osbourne, Black Sabbath.
Judas Priest starts.
Judas Priest.
Punk
Motorhead.
Gets moving. Yeah, Motorhead.
You eventually get into New Wave British heavy metal with Iron Maiden. And stuff like that. It's just when music got better for rock and roll.
And the things that were going to become iconic in the 80s were getting started by the end of that decade, too.
Yep.
Like, again, you said Maiden, or like, you had Aerosmith coming in, the biggest drug fest of a band to ever live. That's a good
time.
Good times. I met people in that band. They were cool. That's another story, though. Oh, gosh. Yeah. That was a great time. Now, here we are. After Altamont, after all this stuff, and people still want to have that Woodstock thing. Try and bring it back, right?
Yeah, they want to have their Woodstock.
Yes, the hippie movement faded into the background really fast. Vietnam went on for a few more years. But people wanted to see if they could kind of bring that peace and love sort of thing back, if they could maybe recapture even a little bit of that sentiment, right? So a man by the name of John Morris, the original Woodstock's stage manager,
hilarious,
attempted to hold what he dubbed Woodstock 2, which would have been exactly as it sounds, basically just a sequel to Woodstock. Like, let's just do it again.
Woodstock 2 Electric Boogaloo.
Yes, and he pitched it to a number of towns in upstate New York. All of which immediately shot his proposals down.
What?
Yes.
Why?
The town of Woodstock itself this time refused a $1 million offer to host the festival, which is funny because, again, it was never held in Woodstock. That was just more of a, Woodstock's the name, it's hip of artists. Let's use that.
Yep.
And kind of
just
kind
of associated it.
Yeah.
Yep.
So they thought, what if we used it now? And they said, no, go away. In fact, in a New York Times article discussing the failed proposal, town supervisor Valerie Cadden was quoted as saying, it has taken us 10 years to recover from the first Woodstock festival.
Oh, my.
Unquote. The town of Meredith actually held a vote on the proposed festival, with turnout being 666 voters in total. Do you want to guess, Ryan, what the results were? We know it failed.
Okay.
I've spoiled that for you, but
okay.
666 votes. And I will also, let me give you another little hint. So they had said that if Woodstock came through, they probably wouldn't have city taxes for about 3 to 5 years because they're going to get paid $1 million, which is
right.
even more money at the time.
Right.
So if we can fund the whole town off Woodstock, we don't have to pay taxes. 668 people voted in upstate New York.
I'm just knowing how much of a disaster the last one was and how much it was burned in their brains. I'm betting most people voted.
Do you want to throw
no.
out a number, see how close you are?
I'm at least 500 out of the 600 had to
you
have voted.
You are
no.
correct. It was 593
oh
no
my God.
To 75.
Oh my God. It was
no.
just under 600.
Yep.
Oh, that's hilarious.
They didn't even get 100 people to agree on this.
That's amazing.
Oh, yes. Again. Paying taxes.
I wonder why.
Paying taxes was more enticing to the people of Meredith, New York than hosting another Woodstock.
That is incredible.
I think that really shows how much of a probably very negative impression this
yep.
first festival had on people in upstate New York, which honestly, seeing how it went, fair.
Fair, yeah.
Completely
absolutely.
Fair. Get that the hell out of here.
No,
don't bring that
no,
here ever
I don't want
again.
It again.
People were very not for this. And by the way, these plans, again, they were tried for years. Like, these are the main ones that were started kind of around 1979 for, like, the 10-year anniversary.
Yep.
People had tried for years before and to maybe try making an annual thing or to have smaller shows or
mm-hmm.
that sort of thing. And other rock festivals also popped up throughout the 70s in upstate New York. A lot of them ended up being kind of messy, too. Gave everyone a bad taste in their mouth. So a lot of towns had just passed, like, ordinances, basically make them impossible.
Oh, that's hilarious.
So by the time Woodstock showed back up, they like a lot of them were already non-starters in the few places they could do it. The name was so poisoned, it was just no.
Yep.
No, go away. It's like, we'll give you $1 million. No. No. Please leave. So eventually, though, this was not to be fully stopped because Woodstock 79 diverged into two reunion shows. One
really?
Held at Madison Square Garden, another at the Parr Meadows Racetrack on Long Island.
Really?
Yes, and again, I believe that it's John Morris and other people involved from the original Woodstock who still put these on. So basically what they're doing is that they were all filled with alumni from the original Woodstocks. Like, Canned Heat was at both. Richie Havens was at Madison Square Garden. Country Joe McDonald was at Parr Meadows, that sort of thing. And more people kind of kept coming in as well to round out the roster here.
Mm-hmm.
There were no new acts booked at either. They were just reunion shows. I mean, originally they wanted to have new acts and kind of make it another Woodstock, but it just
yeah.
floundered. So they're just like, what if we have a reunion show? The thing is, they missed out on a lot of the more famous artists because, you know, Hendrix and Janis Joplin were dead.
Dead.
And other people were not interested in coming, like The Who or The Grateful Dead.
I wonder why.
And the other thing is that some of the people that they could get, a lot of them performed without their, like, famous bands. So, like, for example, Stephen Stills from Crosby, Stills, Nash, and Sometimes Young.
The one not famous member of that band.
Yes, he was the only one there.
That's
be fair,
hilarious.
I've actually heard part of his set. Pretty darn good.
I'm sure it was.
But, like, wow, you got Stills. Like, you got Crosby and Nash? No.
No.
You know, it just kind of becomes that sort of thing. Or
it's
like,
oh, we got the Avengers. Oh, great. Captain America's here.
I got Hawkeye.
No. Yeah, we got Hawkeye. Black Widow's here. Oh,
Nick
that's
Fury's going to be the manager.
Do we got anyone else cooler? Let's see. We've got Archangel, the X-Men. Yeah, we've got him.
Why is he here?
We couldn't find anyone else.
Oof. Yeah, this was also, like, that Crosby, Stills, and Nash thing where only Stephen Stills shows up, that's actually pretty common for this event. Like, there was one guy from the band without the band, Country Joe McDonald without his band, The Fish.
Oh,
and
my.
And many others, like, oh, well, we got Canned Heat. Like, oh, that's pretty good.
All
anyone
right.
else?
Yeah.
That's just kind of how this went. So,
hilarious.
The Brookhaven event was the larger of the two shows. It seems to have run for most of the day as the music began at noon, and the sets I found seemed to be, like, an hour or more. Like, every person got, like, an hour on stage.
That's cool.
So, this probably went on for, I mean, I'd imagine at least, you know, 5-6 hours, if not more.
Gotta
it
be
been
more,
up to like
yeah.
10 or 12. I'm not quite certain on that. But it's estimated to have had between 15,000 to 40,000 people in attendance, which is really pretty good. Like,
yeah,
also, it's a
absolutely.
Big show. But, you know, it's not a local basement show, but pretty small compared to the up to 500,000 people at the last one.
Right.
So it got much less coverage than the original Woodstock did, and it's kind of forgotten. You can actually find, I think, most of it, like, recorded out there.
Cool.
Both of these shows, actually, this one was live broadcast over the radio. So you can find the whole thing. It's out there. You can also find most, if not all, of the Madison Square Garden show. Like, the footage, actually, from that one, too.
Really?
I couldn't find concrete numbers for that Garden show, but it appears to have done, like, okay. I doubt it's sold out. Looking at the numbers now, I know Madison Square Garden holds about 20,000 people at full capacity.
So
I assume it was pretty close back
yeah.
then. I don't think they had that number.
Probably not.
Especially since the other one was bigger, and estimates range from 15 to 40,000. Like, probably not packing to the gills. I mean, I'm sure it was fine.
Mm-hmm.
And again, it sounds good. I'm not trying to knock these events at all. It's just like, oh, they weren't as big as that last one. Again, also 1979... The 80s were on the culture horizon. The hippie movement was thoroughly dead. They had gone through all the 70s. That's going to kill your hippie vibe. So there wasn't the same cultural pull that the original festival was able to luckily tap into. Many commentators pointed that out, by the way.
Makes sense.
And yeah, again, it's just like, overall, they were fine festivals. No one died. No one got hurt.
Mm-hmm.
And they weren't covered in mud. So like, really, by that metric, they were pretty good Woodstocks, actually.
It'd be equivalent if you had like a new metal festival nowadays. Like, oh yeah cool.
We got
awesome.
Yeah, great. We got like, who's
Seven
ever...
Down.
Wow.
And
Korn.
Yeah, and we got Limp Bizkit. We didn't get Fred Durst, but we got Limp Bizkit.
Pretty sure Fred Durst is still in Limp Bizkit.
He is.
We just hired the band, but not him, and told him not to
Couldn't afford it. Couldn't afford it.
I like to imagine they would play a show without him. Like, I don't think they would. Like,
no, they definitely wouldn't. I just thought it was a joke.
No, that's good. No, that's a really funny idea. By the way, I did find a video currently on YouTube at the time of this recording called Woodstock. The Celebration Continues, Madison Square Garden, New York, 1979, which, again, I believe is most, if not all, of the shows. So if you want to see it, it's out there. Again, it sounds good. Canned Heat's always pretty good act. Like,
oh, yeah.
They do well. It's just not as big.
It's just not a... It just isn't a thing.
Yeah, and I should note that recording... And I believe the concert itself did not use the name Woodstock in its advertising. I actually don't believe either of these shows actually officially used the name Woodstock, despite being put on by people who were involved or were there.
Mm-hmm.
I think
that
was
a legal thing.
I think it was. I couldn't find much on that. But as far as I know, the MSG show was called The Celebration Continues, and the Parr Meadow show was called Reunion Concert 1979. And if you've listened to those recordings, they don't say Woodstock in them, or at least not at the beginning when they're kind
right.
of doing the intros.
Interesting.
Like, probably a legal thing, but I'm not 100% certain. I couldn't really find... Like, it's hard to find info on these shows in the first place, let alone what the legal things were. But I'm assuming, if I had to take a wild guess, that's why. So, yeah, they went fine. They usually don't get covered. They're not technically official Woodstocks. You won't find them referenced much. And retrospectives of Woodstocks, I mean, if they ever get covered at all, these things are very just kind of thrown out there. So, they were there.
It's a lot of just taking on, like, statement. There's not... I'd imagine it's the kind of stuff that's really hard to, like, get concrete stuff for.
Yeah, like, again, they seem fine. I'm sure people like them, but, like, oh, you got 30,000 nostalgic former hippies in a...
Cool.
Isn't that cool? All right, moving on. Like, that's kind of what it was.
Yep.
But 1989. This is the Woodstock that people don't talk about other than 94, or 79. We're in the kind of the weird middle ground of Woodstock here. But this one's where it gets really interesting.
Let's
because
go.
This is the Woodstock that like didn't but did happen.
Oh, let's go.
Yeah, all right. So attempts are once again being made almost every other year to hold a Woodstock. But now
shocking.
The 20th anniversary is coming, right?
We gotta have a
show. We have to have a show, right?
We can't not.
This is where Roberts and Rosenman come back, actually. They attempted to hold a 20th anniversary show.
The heroes of our story.
Yes, but could not reach a deal with Michael with anyone, actually, not Michael
right.
Lang. Michael Lang was actually on board for the most part. It was with Warner Brothers that they largely couldn't get because, again, they hold
the
rights for the film,
for
the film and recordings. So they had problems with that. But they were kind of in league with Michael Lang. By the way, there's a really weird sort of like there's suggestions, but I don't know how serious they are, but they get quoted. So, like, for example, Michael Lang suggested holding the show at the Berlin Wall.
That's kind of cool, actually.
Yeah, and it would have been 89, by the way, right as it was coming down.
That would have been really cool.
Yeah. John Morris, again, our stage manager, stage producer, whatever his actual title, I'm sure he had many titles, suggested holding it on an Indian reservation.
That's a weird one.
Yeah. There were other ideas floated. Some people apparently said have it in New York Harbor. I don't know if that was a joke or not. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
That's like the Simpsons movie when they have the Green Day concert
literally.
In Lake Springfield.
Yeah. Like, again, there's also a lot of really weird, like, wacky suggestions people just had because I guess they just hit the planning phase and just ran with it.
No bad ideas, people.
Yeah, by the way, the same sort of ordinances that stopped 79 from being an actual festival, kind of killed 89, too.
Mm.
But There's a very interesting twist in this story.
A plot twist, you say?
There was an event promoter. Not at all, as far as I know, associated with prior Woodstocks.
Okay. Name just a random stranger.
Bruce Taylor, who worked at the Imperial Resort in Swan Lake, New York, close to Bethel. Taylor rounded up a few of the Woodstock alumni and a few other acts as well, like Leon Russell, who was not at the original Woodstock. And they planned for 3 days of concerts hosted at the resort, I believe kind of in like their backyard sort of area.
Okay.
And it's like, all right. And this was called Remember Woodstock. It was his attempt at recreating Woodstock. And I believe he had been like a event promoter at this hotel for like a month. Because every Woodstock is done like under the gun and unplanned.
Of course. It's Woodstock. How else would you do it?
So, yeah. The deadline was, of course, approaching because the 20th anniversary is going to be August 15th. That's when people are going to be, you know, thinking about this, possibly
if that's
the
when they're going to care to do about it, that's when they're going to do it.
Yeah. And again, he had some of the people who were like, okay, like you got Edgar Winter and people who like, okay, people remember that guy, right? Like, and he's still around in this era and like, okay, you got Melanie and like, all right, we can maybe do something of this. Like, and under normal circumstances, this might have done all right. We'll get back to that. There was an interesting thing happening on the Yosker farm where the original Woodstock was held, right?
All right.
A local musician called Rich Pell was planning his own miniature Woodstock.
This is very quickly becoming Game of Thrones.
Yes.
What the heck?
Yes.
Oh my God.
This time he got on the location of the original farm, right? And he actually got permission for a small little concert at the original site.
Really?
He somehow got through all the legal red tape. Somehow. Nothing big. Humble local show, like small stage. And if you look at the footage, I'm talking like small, like,
right.
Like, have you ever been to like a fairground where someone's performing out of like a literal trailer?
Yep.
Like that trailer stage? It's smaller than that.
Oh my, really?
It's like real, or at least like maybe max that size. But it's open air, little sound stage, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like small. Like we're probably expecting hundreds of people max. Hundreds of people max. Like that's a big turnout, right? He had little means of promoting it. And he didn't expect many people to show up, and that was fine. He was just thinking, like, hey, if we get a little reunion, it'll be nice, right? We can maybe
just
capture that spirit.
Just a fun little thing.
Yes.
Something to look back on for the kids.
Yeah, and he didn't view it as a big deal. It's like, hey, I want to get people together, and let's have a little show, and I got permission. Like, hey, cool, we'll have a little Woodstock. It'll be nice.
Yeah.
Right? It's also worth noting, he somehow got this in the same year that the town shot down placing a marker that commemorated the original Woodstock.
That's hilarious.
That would actually not go up until 1994.
Wow, all right.
I don't know. They were apparently still in an anti-Woodstock mood.
Still...
where we can't commemorate it, but you can have a little tiny show.
Mm-hmm.
So
interesting.
I guess the animosity had faded a little bit, but
not
enough.
Didn't want to... It was like, okay, we can just pretend like the small little show isn't happening because it'll be a small little show.
Yeah, that and no one will talk about it
tomorrow. Stone is going to be a reminder.
Mm. Yes. So on the morning of August 15th, a few hundred people show up to the site. There was even a news crew there that you could find the footage of where they talk about, and they interview a few people. And apparently the news crew actually left early that morning, the first one that was
really?
There. Because later, I think some other ones are going to show up, and you'll see why. So they talk about there's some nostalgic kind of baby boomers. And some there was also a lot of younger Gen X people who were coming up at this time. They had heard about this, like, whoa, Woodstock was this thing. Like, what if we just go there and see if anything happens? You know, kind of fun. Actually, I heard a lot of people who showed up were actually younger people.
Interesting.
And again, if you look at the footage, it seems like a good mix of older folks. A lot of them bring their kids and their family.
Mm.
Basically, there's a little camp out starting, right?
Yep.
Little camp out, a few hundred people. And then as this camp out grows, you see a lot more people starting to show up.
Uh-oh.
Rich Pell began planning at 5:07 p.m., again, the exact time that Richie Havens had started at the original Woodstock, right?
That's
so
cute.
Exactly 20 years to the day.
That's really cute. I'm not going to lie.
And by the evening, around 7,000 people had shown up.
Oh, God.
Yeah. And by Friday, estimates had ballooned to about 30,000 people were at
this
thing.
Oh, my God.
The campout just kept growing. And if you look at any footage of this, it's literally just people were camping out and the music came to them.
Yeah.
Like, so yes, this little campout is still growing, right?
Yep.
And you have, remember that other show I mentioned that Mr. Taylor
was
holding?
Yeah, the one in the luxury hotel.
The resort, yes. So funny thing starts happening here because he had organized that event, right?
Yeah.
So because he organized that event, some of the Woodstock alumni were there. So Melanie... and the British band Savoy Brown were pulled from that show to go to this place. And they
played
little sets there.
They poached them. That's hilarious.
And by the way, everyone running this kind of non-event, because there's really nothing happening other than Richard Pell's little thing.
Yeah.
And then other people started showing up. Local artists started lining up to play this show, by the way. And I don't, it kind of sounds like, again, to me, like they play like kind of in little pods or all over the place. Like I know some people rotated throughout the main stage, which again is tiny, but I think they kind of played all over. So like a bunch of local artists showed up. They started playing fun little shows. People again had brought their kids and families. Again, it's just a big camp out. But yeah, Melanie shows up and then other people start showing up and it's like, oh, we actually had a little Woodstock reunion. people estimated, and I wonder if these might be a little inflated, but the estimates for, like, the course of this campout,
yeah, as people like coming in and coming out,
reached 100,000 to 200,000.
Oh my god!
Supposedly,
what?
Supposedly, again, I'm not quite sure because they mentioned a lot of people showed up after like the events had stopped, but like
right.
It's not a scheduled planned event. So when does the event stop? Like when
yeah,
the last
yeah,
guy?
What's the cutoff?
Yeah, like when the last guy stops storming a guitar. Like that probably happens every day there, right?
Yep,
like,
yep.
I'm sure people visit that site every single day. Like, just because, especially now, because there's a market where even back then, I'm sure there were people kind of coming and going, a little touristy, like, you get 15 people here and there.
Yeah.
That kind of thing. So I'm not quite sure how they're running those numbers. Apparently,
it's
this...
still
like,
crazy. Like,
yeah, tens of thousands of people
true.
Came here, right?
Yeah.
And this is great, because the nostalgia kind of goes in, people are hanging out. Like, Jimi Hendrix's dad actually showed up.
Really?
Al Hendrix, he was just there, and he said, the spirit of Woodstock is back, and he was just there.
Huh.
I guess...
All right.
Yeah, like,
cool.
It sounded really cool. Like, people just started hanging out and camping, and, like, they set up tents and did the old thing again, then went back home probably on the weekend, and, yeah, it sounds
super
nice.
Cool.
And the funny thing is, you know, Taylor, the guy setting this up?
Yep.
That other show?
Yep.
Completely overshadowed by the big campout. He actually made an appearance at the campout, right?
Yeah.
Because he, and this is really funny if you watch the footage, because there's footage of him going on stage, and he says, hi, and he announces his name and where he's from, and people start booing.
Really?
And it's like, that's kind of mean. And he's like, no, hang on a second. Like, just let me go on here. And he talks about how he's got, like, I've got Melanie, I've got Edgar Winter, and all these other people at a nice luxury hotel over here, and like, boo. And he's like, hang on. And he's like, they performed yesterday to a crowd of 250 people. He's like, it's the best concert I've ever seen in my life, and I love this Woodstock thing, and I'm just wanting to offer you all free tickets to this show.
Oh, that's
to go
cool.
And see it. Because, like, I think they should have a show. And then he actually wins over the crowd. They start cheering.
That's really cool.
And it's like, I honestly think that, like, he just wanted to share this Woodstock experience.
Yeah.
It's probably a guy just like the original promoters, kind of in over
kind
his head.
Kind of just thought it was really cool and
yeah.
be a fun little thing.
Yeah, and like, it sounds like on one of the nights, like when Melanie performed at his show, about 100 people, which are claimed to be mostly hotel staff, were there. And it's like, oh man. And then she was more interested in going to the other show, but like, it sounds like, again, he wasn't, the Taylor who set this up wasn't too, like, busted up about it. He's like, yeah, like, I understood that they kind of stole our thunder, but who cares? I wanted Woodstock to kind of come back anyways.
So
he's kind of feeling about
way.
It. Yeah, so.
Very serendipitous.
He makes a very interesting point, by the way, that I couldn't find any article that mentioned this, by the way. I only saw it in the footage, where he mentions that, again, when he's on stage in front of these people, which it's not a huge crowd either, but he's on that little stage,
yeah.
And he talks about how his event, he had to go through like red tape and all this other stuff to go and get even his thing at like a resort, which I'm assuming is private land the resort owns. He even had to go through all of the red tape for like to get that held, right?
Yeah.
To have these people show up there. And he talks about how because of my event, this is why this is happening, which I think is it's either be talking about like the whole big gathering or he's talking about like Rich Pell's thing that he set up where
yeah.
like because everyone was so distracted worrying that his big resort show was going to be a problem, they didn't really care about the little show.
Yeah, which makes
right?
sense.
And so he's like talking about, yeah, we opened the gates for you all, like we'd love to have you at our show. They're passing out free tickets, that kind of thing. He's trying to explain that basically because of his show, that's why anything at the campout's happening.
Mm-hmm.
Which I'm actually inclined to believe is true, is that
it
he
would make
probably
sense.
Was the one taking most of the heat on that.
Because they were probably mostly focused on it, because like, oh, that could actually be a big show, because it's
yeah.
at like a luxury hotel.
He spent $80,000 on his show,
yeah,
by
yeah,
the way.
Yeah, like, so it's definitely going to be like, oh, that's going to be the big one if there's a problem.
Yes.
Not the one out in
and
the
And then
dairy
he
bar.
Mentions it was a grand total of 250 people at his $80,000 concert, and it's like, wow, he probably lost his shirt on that, didn't
yep.
he? It's like, oh, that's a shame,
yep.
but... It gets me thinking, like, okay, if they have a more respectable, like, hotel kind of promoter going through this red tape, does that change things in the background here? Is this kind of what opens up? Because, again, a few years later, you're going to get to the Woodstocks that you might have heard about.
Right.
right. Those other ones that we're going to talk about here. But you're opening up this show, it's like, oh, he might have kind of opened the floodgates for that a little bit. And, again, because of his event, that's why the big campout happens.
Yep.
You get maybe 100,000 people or more there. People have that kind of, you know, big, you know, hangout festival, big campsites, you know, the local artists come. And that's basically where the story ends there. It's just, it became the spontaneous event. It was all run by volunteers, by the way.
In a weird way, it was the most Woodstock of all the Woodstocks.
Yes, it was. And no one got hurt there. It seems like people had a great time. And honestly, of all the Woodstocks is what I'd like to see the most, just
yeah,
because
absolutely.
Like, whoa, I want to see like just people hanging out. And
it just seems very serendipitous, the whole thing. Like
yeah.
it just sort of came to be because the energy was there. You
yeah,
know?
And just the desire to have another Woodstock came. And so for really the only other time outside the original Woodstock, it just... kind of happened. and nothing really went super wrong. And it's interesting, again, this is 89. Woodstock 94 is going to be coming up soon.
Mm-hmm.
And that's going to be, again, upstate New York. It's like, did this going well set up 94?
Yeah.
And I have to wonder, again, it's hard to find because you'd have to either scan through legal documents that may or may not exist anymore,
mm-hmm.
or talk to people who may or may not be alive to really find out, like, the really nitty-gritty, like, did this lead to this? Because Michael Lang's unfortunately dead, but Michael Lang was at Woodstock 89. Wavy Gravy also showed up at Woodstock 1989, and Wavy Gravy was supposed to be at the other show, but then he got pulled out to go to the campout because it sounded more fun to him, and he said, whoa, this is cool. And again, Michael Lang's there, and people are hanging out and giving little speeches and doing their thing.
Back into the background of the mine, and it starts to, it really starts to pull away from all the negative stuff that happened at the OG Woodstock, and now it's just all this.
We've kind of grown up a bit. The kids will like it. You can bring people there, and it's like, you don't think, knowing Michael Lang, he saw this happening and thought,
I can make money.
In 5 years, it's going to be the 25th anniversary. Yeah, I might be able to do this myself. I mean, I'm not going to assume,
but,
it's possible.
Cause and effect is there.
Yes, foreshadowing is a big part of this story.
Yes.
Too. And again, you get...
I hope you're taking notes, kids.
Yes. So I wanted to mention this just because, again, it just kind of ends and people go home eventually, and it sounds really nice. There's some recordings of it out there if you want to find it, but it's like, wow, huh, you brought some of the original Woodstock people back together.
Yeah.
Including their promoters. The people who are going to be involved in that next official Woodstock, you don't
say.
I wonder if anyone noticed there was a market for this. So, yeah, so that's how Woodstock 89 both completely failed and also was a massive, massive success. So, yeah, that's what I
Very
got
cool.
for the Woodstocks you've never heard of. And I'm going to end this episode here at 89. We'll go into the other ones on the next one.
Wonderful.
So do you have any final thoughts on these Woodstocks, Ryan? You got anything to wrap up with?
Honestly, more than anything, I just am blown away that I had never heard of Woodstock 89.
Yeah, like, people don't talk about it.
Because, like, the big you always hear about the big three. You hear about 69, then you hear about the 25th and 94, and then you hear about 99, of course.
Yes, the three that were official.
Yep, but I'm just amazed. Like, I had no idea that it ever happened. It seems like something out of a fairy tale, and I very much agree with your observation that 89 really had to have paved the way for 94 and then eventually 99, because, like, just set, like, talking about how, like, people still thought about Woodstock 69 before that, and how, like, clear that, like, the towns in and around the area were still like, you want to have a music festival in our town? No, we remember what happened last time. We're good.
Mm-hmm.
I really can't help but feel like 89 did a lot to make people go, well, maybe we could do this again. Maybe the energy's still there. Maybe there is still, like, maybe the hope's still alive. The dream's still alive. Maybe our dreams haven't become memes yet.
Yeah, and you also have to wonder, like, again, this was much more of a local thing. They didn't bring in a bunch of artists. It was more serendipitous anyone was there.
It was just, it wasn't like a big pre-planned out thing like the other ones were. It wasn't this whole big machine that was bigger than itself. It was just a thing that kind of happened.
It's kind of like a county fair, almost, just way bigger is what it sounds like. And there was just people camped out and people were there, and your local artists were on stage for a little bit and they did their thing. And, like, you can't tell me that people from the local communities didn't feel some sort of pull to kind of check it out. And like, once they heard that people were just hanging out,
do you hear there's a free concert going on outside of town where
and your buddy's playing in whatever random band, like, oh, I hear a lot of people there, it's gonna be the one time we're gonna
be
chance.
Drinking, there's gonna be all sorts of fun stuff you can do. Why wouldn't you? It's small town New York.
Yeah, why not? Let's see what happens. So you can't tell me it didn't soften the image a little bit.
Absolutely.
Maybe put some of those bad memories to rest, at least a little bit. I mean,
yep.
It just follows. Again, I can't quite prove it because you have to talk to the right people and all this stuff.
It's
but
one of those
things. It seems like a completely logical thing that's how it goes.
Yep.
So there you have it again. And, oh, by the way, if anyone listening was at any of the Woodstocks,
please
get in touch. Send me an email or carrier pigeon or however you communicate.
Smoke signal. Preferred for me.
Yes, any of them. Ryan does do smoke signals, I think. I don't know.
Maybe. I do.
Who do you talk to?
My friends.
Oh, I guess that makes sense. Who else would you send smoke signals to?
I don't know. Sometimes my family, but not as often. They prefer carrier pigeon like you.
That's fair. That's a completely respectable. I also got in the messenger.
He's got bad lungs nowadays. So the smoke signals just aren't so good for him anymore.
You can't go into the old sweat lodge anymore and get the roof going.
No, it just doesn't work like it used to.
Darn. Well, he probably would have liked Woodstock 89. It was nice and open air. And
he would have loved it. He would have loved it.
Oh, boy. Well, anyways, we'll leave the story there for today, and we'll continue on with those bigger, perhaps more exciting, but also more dangerous concerts.
Far more dangerous.
We'll be covering Woodstock 94 and 99 after this. Stay tuned, folks. We'll see you on the next one.
Bye.